Hey everybody, we are back. It is the second episode of the Jack Murphy Live podcast, and I am joined here today by Will Chamberlain, Mr. Periscope. Will, how are you doing today?
Doing fantastic.
Will is a lawyer and a political commentator, and he has been keeping us all up to date on a number of issues that have been happening, most notably in the recent past, the Kavanaugh hearings and everything leading up to that. Will was on the ball and on the spot with that and had great success with his periscopes. Everything went well with that, didn't it, Will?
Yeah, gained a lot of followers, got a lot of traction. I mean, that's the measure of success on Twitter and Periscope, I think.
It certainly is. Plus, you're getting the good word out there, and I think that you got a lot of traction with that. So that's been exciting. And then here to my left, because we're sitting at my dining room table at Jack Murphy Live Worldwide Headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Nerd.
She's shaking her head at me. I have the lovely Red Hen. And we're going to just keep calling her the Red Hen this whole time because that's her pen name and that's her name.
Sure. Yeah, I'm totally okay with that.
You're totally okay with that? Mm-hmm. And she and Will both are going to be sort of like rotating regular co-hosts, mostly because they live in Washington, D.C. and I'm friends with them. But really because both of them have a great perspective to bring to the various conversations that we're having. And on the podcast here, you know, we're going to have a whole slew of experts and people who know things about a lot of different things. I said that really well for a professional word guy. Mm-hmm. Come by and talk about on a whole different range of topics. And so sometimes we're going to talk about sex and relationships. It'd be always nice to have a female perspective on that. Sometimes we're going to talk about politics and culture, and that's why I've got Will here. He's the expert. Sometimes we're just going to talk about whatever, and all three of us are experts on that. Perfect.
I'm very good at whatever.
You're very good at whatever.
It happens to be a specialty.
Recently, the Red Hen and I just came back from the University of New Mexico, but actually not even the University of Mexico because I got banned before I got there.
Mm-hmm. We never made it.
So as part of my fall 2018 Democrat to the Plurable book tour, I was scheduled to speak at the University of New Mexico at the law school. A faculty member there reached out to me and invited me directly. Like in the other instances with the college Republicans and stuff, I've been reaching out to them and setting up these dates. But University of New Mexico Law School reached out to me directly and paid for both of our flights, paid for our hotel, asked us to come out there and give a talk. But the night before, we were like bags packed. Everything was by the door. We were like getting ready to go to bed early because we had a flight the next morning. And we get a call saying, hey, guess what? You're canceled. You're banned. Jack Murphy, too dangerous. No, well, you can't roll your eyes on the podcast. You have to say stuff. And so the lady in New Mexico, she told me that she had met with the head of the law school and that she had met with security there. And they were told that there was like going to be security threats. Some sort of danger or risk to the people who may be attending my talks, which is crazy, isn't it? Well, like, I'm not, we know people that are far more outrageous and provocative than I am.
Right. I mean, part of how the left operates, I guess, now is that they just come out, they threaten you, and that's how they bully these administrations, which probably didn't want to host you in the beginning, from hosting you. They create a pretext, right? Because if a popular left-wing speaker was coming to speak at the University of New Mexico Law School, and some right winger came out and threatened them, do you really think that New Mexico would ban that speaker?
No.
Odds are extremely low.
Right. No, they would just tell that protester just to go home and be quiet about it because, hey, free speech, right? So we go out there anyway, right? The head of security says no. The head of the law school says no. They cancel the event one day before, and they cite, because it was like the day before midterm elections, and they cite, it's too dangerous to have these conversations right before midterm elections. Does that,
right.
That sounds like the America that I know.
It sounds like you're engaging in election meddling, Jack. Sounds like we need a special counsel investigation just for you.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the truth is that I think that my subject matter isn't really that provocative. Definitely not what's in the book, Democrat to Deplorable. I mean, it doesn't seem provocative to me. But maybe some of the older stuff, you know what happens? They start Googling, right? Mm-hmm. And there are hit pieces out there on me that just won't go away. The search engine optimization is pretty good and they've got good platform power. So people will start Googling and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, this guy can't come. And then free speech is in jeopardy and that's that. But
the Google problem is one that essentially it's like it's part of the broader warfare, right? It only works because the left has so much dominant cultural power. I was thinking about this the other day, or really just this morning, that, you know, people who support Trump and support the president, they're the people who are vulnerable to being deplatformed. People who oppose the president are not vulnerable to being deplatformed. Now, in a world where Republicans were as powerful as the left often thinks of them as, right? They say, oh, you know, the Republicans have Congress, they have the executive branch, they have so much power, they're going to have the courts. We don't have that sort of same cultural power at all, like nothing resembling it. And so people who support the government of the United States are at risk of being deplatformed. People who oppose it are lionized. It's a weird power asymmetry. And it also made me think that if the right actually had cultural power in the way that the left does, the left would never win an election again, ever.
Ever.
Right? Ever. Yeah. Right? Like,
well, and they act like the exact opposite is true, right? That,
right.
That, like, Republicans and people that support Donald Trump have this cultural power, they have this influence, or they have the money, or they're the elites, or they're dominant, or whatever the case may be. But the truth is that from universities, professional organizations, institutions, media institutions, entertainment, marketing, advertising, all the way up and down the entire spectrum of American culture, the left is in charge and the liberals are running things.
Right. And the left has to look at it differently because part of their entire narrative is David versus Goliath. Their self-justifying narrative of why the story they tell themselves is that they are fighting either oppressed themselves or fighting on behalf of oppressed populations against the powerful. But you actually look, if you think hard about who actually has power, elite, there was no money for Trump, and there really wasn't a lot of money for Republican candidates this cycle. There was tons of money for Democratic candidates. And the realignment that occurred in the wake of 2016 moved a lot of elite coastal Republicans to the Democratic side. And the trade-off is that we now have a fighting chance of winning the Rust Belt and a fighting chance of winning the presidency. But the downside is we have a lot less money to do it with than we used to as a Republican Party. And it also means that cultural power is much more consolidated with the Democrats because they not only have the cultural power that comes from Hollywood and academia, and they now have the additional cultural power of all the sort of elite Republicans, their money and their periodicals, things like the Weekly Standard and you know, all the people who are on CNN and being really annoying.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that it struck me in this last the midterms with the Texas campaign for Senate, apparently some unheard of amount of money, out of state money, flowed into Texas to try to influence the Senate mm-hmm. campaign, right? And I started to think, when we're talking about this idea of Russian influence and outside meddling on the national political scene, how is that not analogous to outside money from outside of a state flowing into a state to try to sway voters by people who don't live in that state and who don't vote in that state and aren't domiciled in that state? It's like literal, actual, out of jurisdiction meddling in an election, is it not?
Sure. And I mean, as well as the media's decision to just drown everybody in coverage of Beto O'Rourke and ignore his flaws, which are pretty profound. I mean, the dude had a DUI, and not just any DUI, like a DUI and a hit and run in his late 20s, I think, is the time period. That's not that long ago, you know.
Yeah, for him.
For him, he's a younger guy. And then you had people like John James in Michigan, right? John James, young, black entrepreneur, Air Force pilot, nearly, you know, fighting hard, getting a lot of votes, doing pretty well, you know, in a rough cycle for Republicans in a state that's generally been pretty Democratic. He only lost by like 5. Zero coverage from the mainstream media. And that's what that gives you. And so from my perspective, like, you getting deplatformed at New Mexico is part of the broader theme of conservatives finding themselves deplatformed in academia, is part of the broader theme of the media covering Democrats and Republicans completely differently, which is all a part of this broad cultural power that Democrats can bring to bear and that Republicans currently can't.
Well, and what strikes me as being particularly nefarious is that I'm actually out here trying to build bridges. Like, I'm trying to help people understand how you can have a political realignment or a cultural awakening, but also trying to use the language and the ideas from both sides to try to bring people together.
Can't do that. That's like, still a threat.
Right. I think that's even
if you bring everyone together, then there's no victims. There's no oppressor. Mm-hmm. They have no mission.
Right. So I'm out here building bridges and people are trying to tear me down. And that should tell you a lot about where we are in this, our current climate today.
No, we're not unified. It's possible in the next 2 years we will be, because maybe Pelosi and Trump start working together. Like, oddly enough, after Pelosi's speech in the aftermath of the midterms, I was like, I hope she's speaker, because she's making noises like she actually wants to get things done, which would be unbelievably good for the overall social climate, right? If Democrats in Congress work together with Republicans in the Senate and Trump and actually pass a few pieces of major legislation, that would be a huge...
That would be amazing.
...temperature reducing moment.
Yeah, which is exactly why I can't imagine anything like that ever really happening. I mean, that you could Trump could say, I will sign whatever Democratic fantasy bill that you want. I just want the Democrats to love me. I'll do whatever you want in the whole wide world, Pelosi. Just put it on my desk. And they still wouldn't vote anything across the table if they knew that it had Trump support. That's my take on it. I mean, I would love to see like an actual infrastructure spending bill. Like, if you're going to spend money, mm-hmm. let's invest it in the United States on things that we're all going to reap the benefit of. We're going to put people to work. We're going to buy U.S. steel and concrete and all kinds of great stuff. But I can't see that happening, because how could they possibly give him a victory? How could they give Trump a victory?
No, they can't. I mean, that's the problem with, you know, politics based on resistance. It's mm-hmm. like you have to resist, and that means you don't let anything that Trump could get credit for pass.
Right. It'll be bad for the brand too, for all those Democrats.
I was going to say, it's like a brand issue.
How could they work with him? Those traitors, they don't really represent us.
Right.
Well, I'm out here trying to build bridges, man. People are tearing me down, but the tour continues. In fact, I guess I'll probably air this afterwards, but I'm going to Rutgers tomorrow night on the 13th, mm-hmm. driving up to New Jersey to speak to some college Republicans. And then after that, we've got Evergreen State College coming up.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
There's some question about my talk at Columbia University, but we're going to get into that a little bit later as the time approaches. But I'm definitely going to Evergreen State College still.
Awesome.
So that should be
awesome.
That's going to be fun.
That should be a good barometer.
Enemy territory.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Right behind enemy lines.
The Vipers Pit. Pit of Vipers? Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure how that goes here.
I just think of Ragnar every time you say that.
Oh, right. Because Ragnar got...
just makes me sad.
He got murdered by like being thrown into a pit of snakes.
A literal pit filled with vipers.
Right. That didn't look like the best way to go. No, but it's good for your mythology.
Totally.
Yeah. I love Ragnar. Vikings is coming. Can't wait for that. Vikings is coming. Okay. So here are some of the topics that we're going to try to get to today. We're going to get to nationalism versus globalism and patriotism, where that all fits in there. And what sort of, is there such a thing as nationalism or libertarian nationalist? That's something that I've been thinking quite a lot about, actually. I went to George Mason for economics undergrad, so I'm pretty well steeped in libertarian market-based thinking. But I've been toying with this idea of like how, what if, do these values end at a border? And are borders real or abstract? And should they impact the way that markets work and the way your morality is applied to other human beings? Mm-hmm. So we're going to get to that. But the first thing I want to talk about is this nationalism versus globalism thing that's in the news right now. So why don't you sort of get us all up to speed and describe what's been happening?
So I think it was either yesterday or the day before, probably yesterday, where Emmanuel Macron, the prime minister of France, got up and said that nationalism was treason, that it was the opposite of patriotism. And he said that while Trump was sitting right there in the audience. And Trump had famously declared himself to be a nationalist about 3 weeks ago at a rally. And this criticism of nationalism kind of feeds off of some of the American criticisms. People like Bill Kristol, but a whole bunch of progressives as well. Caitlin Collins at CNN famously saying, nationalism is Hitler. Why would you want to be Hitler? Like, as erudite as that seems. And so you have,
she made a Hitler reference.
She made a Hitler reference. 26-year-old, you know, journalism graduate gets up and says, why is he calling himself a nationalism? This is what nationalism means. It's like, no, you're 26. You don't know what nationalism means. You just don't.
We should elect her to Congress.
Yeah. No, I mean, funny thing is, I actually think we can get into, that's another interesting topic of conversation. The Republicans are completely messing up with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she's going to be a star.
But messing up how?
By like trying to hit her for being poor, basically, and like not being super smart about being able to afford things. Like,
I had a really good tweet about that.
Yeah.
I tweeted what kind of person wakes up in the morning and says, you know who we need making laws in America? 20-something chicks that can't afford an apartment without a government job. Now, I thought twice about sending that tweet. And, you know, it's always the ones where you're like, maybe I shouldn't send this one that do really well.
It's true.
Yeah, that one blew up. But, you know, it's a joke. Mm-hmm. I don't mean it 100% literally. But at the same time, you know, it's interesting to think, how many people do you run into in their 20s at all, mm-hmm. male or female, rich or poor, that you would feel comfortable making laws to apply to the population in general? So I wasn't making a sexist comment or even a classist comment. It was really ageist, because I'm really an ageist.
And that's fair. Most of the time I find myself pretty frustrated by like kids in their early 20s, because I know what I thought in my early 20s. It's totally different from what I think today, 10 years later.
Right.
It was really stupid.
Right. But with much more confidence.
Oh, yeah. I was super confident that I had figured out world politics. Just completely figured it out.
Why wouldn't anybody just listen to me?
Right. Like, we should have seasteads in the middle of the ocean to compete with governments so that they can put competitive pressure on existing governments to serve their citizens better. I genuinely thought that was like the solution to politics.
Duh. It's so simple, you guys.
You mean just like living on an abandoned oil platform or something like that?
Yeah, somebody actually did that. There's all sorts of stuff. Like, there was some dude, Sealand, S-E-A-L, mm-hmm. and Sealand was on this abandoned oil platform somewhere in the North Atlantic. They put a data haven there. It's like this hyper libertarianism, basically.
Yeah, well, no, it's not a terrible idea. We can get back to the young congresswoman, and we can get back to the young lady on CNN calling Trump. Oh my God, Nazi! That was really original. Do you think she sat around at night trying to come up with a negative term?
I think it's a product of a 3 weeks long creative process. is what that is.
Okay, so. We're talking about nationalism and Trump's definition of nationalism, and Marcon of France is saying that basically Trump is Hitler too, is what he's saying.
Effectively, which is really just one, disrespectful from a head of state, especially of a head of a vassal state of the United States. Oh,
zing. Zing.
Sorry, you don't get to be an independent country if you are dependent on another country's military umbrella, and to mm-hmm. be disrespectful of the leader of
right.
the country that's
to
providing
his face.
To his face is quite something.
And what event was this at?
This was at the World War One Armistice Day event in France.
Oh my God. So it was actually in a moment where they're honoring American, what are they honoring? American contribution to the ending World War?
I think all contribution.
All contribution. Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that politically tone deaf on Marcon's part, or is that calculated?
No, I mean, a little of both. I think he's already hurting very badly in the polls in France. Like his approvals spike and go from anywhere from like 20 to 30% for an approval rating, which is shocking compared to, you know, Trump has like a 44% approval rating.
Not if you talk to Rasmussen.
Right. I'm all the way up about 50, but no, I mean, Macron is not popular, but he's popular among people I would refer to as globalists.
Mm-hmm. And what's your working definition of globalist?
So a globalist is a person who, I believe, prioritizes the interests of humanity above the interests of their own nation, right? And by nation, I mean aligned with the nation state. So, you know, if I'm an American nationalist, I prioritize the interests of the American nation, American citizens, over the interests of people of other countries. And the thing about it is, you ask most people and most citizens of their own countries, do they want their leaders to prioritize their interests or the interests of people from other countries? They'll say, I want you to prioritize my interests. Moreover, you know, many of the commitments made by people who consider themselves kind of these global citizen types, they're committed to things like universal healthcare in their own countries. It's extremely hard to justify universal healthcare in your own country if you don't believe that you should prioritize the interests of your own citizens above those of other countries. Universal healthcare is really expensive, and it's a benefit that goes solely to your own citizens. That's money that could get more bang for the buck in terms of improving health outcomes in Africa or Southeast Asia or any number of other places, and you don't spend it there. You spend it on your own citizens. Why? Because at a certain point, we all kind of intuitively understand that it's moral to prioritize the interests of your community above other communities, right? And so when that community extends to the nation state, you know, it's like people who prioritize the interests of faraway people and don't care about their own family. We immediately think of that as like
that's appalling. Strange. Yeah.
You know, and just something immoral and unethical.
Well, you have to help yourself in order to be able to help other people.
Right.
You know, I mean, you have to be in a position of strength in order to help others.
Right. But there's also just the sort of like, why don't you care about your own family? You know, like right. You know, even on a basic level, I don't know, you've probably had this experience. I've had it with, you know, personal issues with my own family where I've had very close relations kind of distance themselves from me as a result of just being involved in right-wing politics. And my mm-hmm. parents, other people have like found this appalling. Mm-hmm. And it's like, why do we find that so intuitively appalling? Because, well, obviously you're supposed to care most about your family, care most about, you know, that's blood. That's your core people you're supposed to care about.
So presumably these globalists have their own tribe, right? Their own family that they're presuming to care about. Who's that?
I mean, I think they... I'm not sure. I mean, there's sort of the difference between their explicit remarks and their implicit behavior, right? So the explicit remarks are their family. They're not caring more about the citizens than non-citizens, right? They are very, very deeply caring about the rights of the other. And that's part of signaling about that's a way of signaling virtue. Implicitly, they end up caring most about the people who agree with them politically. Right. And so that ends up being the core in group that they truly defend and hold to a different standard than everybody else. Right. So it's like,
are there financial interests, power interests, control, things like that, that bind those people together? Is that why?
No, I'm not. I don't think it's nearly that pragmatic or sort of like hard headed, because I don't think that's why people like why the left kind of stays together in that way. There's not some cynical underlying blood for, you know, kind of like we want the money, we want the oil like motivation. I genuinely mm-hmm. think these people are, you know, have what they definitely see as a higher motivation than that, which is, you know, looking out for the good of humanity, looking out for the good of the environment, looking out for the other and the oppressed. And then if you're a person who signals properly that you do those things, then you end up being part of the in-group that does effectively get treated that way. Because I guess another point to be made is that there's always going to be some sort of in-group whose interests you prioritize over the broader population. Like even as a one humanity liberal, in effect, in the way you behave, you're going to essentially treat your closer relations to a different standard.
Well, and excuse me, where does that come from? I mean, that's because we're tribal animals that are used to living in small groups.
Right.
And here we are now interfacing, you know, instead of with 30 to 50 people, we're interfacing with like 7 billion people.
Right.
And so it's a natural tendency to find your own tribe and find your own group and have your own in-group. And I think that's a natural instinct that plays itself out on the political spectrum on all sides. It's just that, I guess in this question, it's, you know, is your in-group going to be the people that live next door to you, or is your in-group going to be people that are living on the other side of the planet?
Right. And it shouldn't be the people who live on the other side of the planet. I think that it's not moral to ignore those closest to you. And then like think all the time that you're moral because you care about the interests of those in sub-Saharan Africa. It's not saying that you shouldn't care about people in Southern Saharan Africa. I think you should, but it's like having concentric circles of caring, and right. as they expand outward, those bonds become less strong.
Right. Well, and you know, that this sort of my model for self-improvement and development too, which is take care of yourself first. That's your number one priority. Mm-hmm. Take care of your body, take care of your mind. Get enough sleep, get enough food, get enough to eat. And it's not because of a selfish reason where like I love myself the most, so I'm going to take care of myself that way. No, it's so that you can be a better utility to the people who are around you. Mm-hmm. So you can be a better and higher, greater use to your immediate family. And then if you get that taken care of, then your community a little bit broader, maybe your nation, maybe the world. But if you spend your time worrying about the nation and the world first, mm-hmm. then your internal, you know, yourself, your individual self is going to suffer for it. And I think that's sort of where the nationalism, globalism debate is really falling right now is it possible to be concerned with the welfare of people outside of your in-group, outside of your nation state as a priority, and then still maintain the independent, inherent value and strength of yourself as an individual or your nation state as an individual? And to me, it's insane that this is even like a real question. Mm-hmm. How do you think that this idea of taking care of your own citizens with your own national interests first, How did that become a pejorative, and where and when do you know? I mean, maybe we none of us know, but how did this really happen?
So I think it's a combination of two big, sort of one big historical event and then one big academic intellectual trend, right? So first, the historical event is World War II, which while people like Yoram Hazzoni, who's a really, really good thinker on nationalism, he views Germans' ideology as imperialistic, right? It wasn't nationalist in the sense of respecting individual nation states. It was imperialistic. It was trying to impose a German empire, German dominion over other states, which is, and he draws that distinction. I do too. But the way that the general world treated World War II is an outbreak of nationalism. It's just too much. And that we need to shut it down. Oddly enough, replacing it with like this European Union, which is yet another sort of distinct, but another imperialist idea, right? A liberal imperialist idea instead of a racist imperialist idea, but ultimately still imperialist.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one trend, the sort of World War II making nationalism a dirty word, because that's what the intellectuals associated with Hitler, with Stalin, with others. And then the second is the ultimate resurgence of, I think, Marxism on the left in academia, because underlying Marxism, especially classical Marxism, is the idea that classes cross internationally will unify to revolt against higher classes.
Workers of the world unite.
Right. And so there's a natural tendency to find the nationalistic impulse somewhat reactionary, somewhat retrograde. So, you know, it's interesting to see some of the more sophisticated Marxist thinkers, a guy like Benedict Anderson, who wrote a book called Imagined Communities, when they come to actually grapple with nationalism, because they've had these situations where two Marxist countries invaded one another, right? Go back to Southeast Asia in the 70s and 80s, you had like Vietnam and Cambodia attacking each other in wars. These are both Marxist nations in good standing among the international communist movement, but they're attacking each other. Due to these strong nationalistic impulses. So they've had to grapple with it in their own way. But overall, I think the fact that academia leads so leftwards is this really force against nationalism. Because if you're pro this kind of, you know, one world humanity, pro proletariat in the classical sense, or just pro the unification of marginalized oppressed peoples, nationalism doesn't really fit into that matrix at all.
Right. And the people that were in charge of and running nationalistic countries also tended to be the property owners and the entrepreneurs and the people of power and the landed people. And so, you know, that is the natural enemy to Marxism, obviously. It all starts with property rights. And, you know, I guess interestingly enough, if you take a very specific approach to nationalism, it's really about defending personal property rights.
Kind of. I mean, it's something more than that, right? Like, what is, so this helps to understand, like, what is a nation, right? Like, what is, a nation is an imagined community, right? That's the key line out of Benedict Anderson. The idea is that we don't know all 300 million people in the United States, but we, like, collectively conceptualize ourselves as part of a nation with them. And we all jointly have this imagination together. Again, by saying it's imaginary, that doesn't mean it's not real in the sense of...
Right, it's just not tangible.
It's just not tangible, exactly.
Yeah. And this is a key point that was made in the Sapiens book as well.
I remember reading Sapiens and he made the exact same argument. I'm pretty sure he also read Anderson himself.
Right, being able to organize around an imaginary concept.
Right. But what roots that imaginary concept and makes it things that people go out and fight and die for, you know, culture... language, history, shared myths, shared values, all those things are really tangible to people. It's, you know, we joke about, you know, we, for one thing that we do on Twitter, we fly the flag, right? I have a flag and my name is bio. We put flags when it's close to election time. The reason we do that is because the flag is just this incredibly powerful symbol that makes people think more about their nation and more conservative. So we want people in the run up to election to see flags, lots of them, lots of American flags. It's an incredibly powerful motivating force for people. I mean, it motivates people to fight and die. It's motivated them to fight and die for hundreds of years. This national identity, protection of the nation, as opposed to merely their tribe. And so that isn't really going anywhere. The question is, do you harness that? And do you ramp up the positive benefits of it? or do you try and squelch it? And I feel like the left and Macron and all these people are like, nationalism is this evil, dirty thing we need to try and squelch. It's like, well, one, it's not, and you're slandering your own countrymen, and countrywoman by doing that. But two, you can't squelch it. If you try and squelch it, you'll lose because you don't prioritize the interests of the people that everybody else thinks you probably should be prioritizing.
I think what's interesting is that if you put it in a historical perspective, nationalism is a fairly recent concept, right? I mean,
well, even the nation state itself.
Well, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the American Revolution and the French Revolution, 18th century, is really the first manifestation of any type of nationalism. And I think many people would see that as a positive, mm-hmm. right? And then it grew. It grew in, like, in Europe, the 19th century is considered to be the peak of European nationalism. That is something that defines the 19th century in Europe. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, the United States, super nationalism, we're closed off, we're not participating, we're caring about America. And now we're transitioning all the way to the other side, mm-hmm. where now nationalism is in its other extreme, right? Mm-hmm. So now it's globalism. It's not nationalism. And we're having these conversations about what is it, you know, because it's such a recent concept, essentially, if you think about how many
human history.
Right, of human history. I mean, think about how long people have discussed, you know, what is democracy. Now we're talking about what is nationalism. And if you could do away with nationalism, what is left? Because before nationalism, it was divided into, like, all the Christians were together, and then there was this Muslim world, and then, you know, we've divided ourselves into tribes always. Mm-hmm. And so the way we've organized the world now is based on nations. And so if we get rid of that concept, what is the world? I mean, one extreme would be like, it's going to dissolve. I mean, well, something else has to bind us all together.
I still can't get past this question of, you know, if Donald Trump hadn't said that he was a nationalist, would Marcon be saying nationalism is bad?
No,
probably not.
No.
Right. And so how much of this sort of anti-nationalistic, I'm making air quotes that you guys can't see, how much of this anti-nationalistic rhetoric is just politically motivated out of spite and anger and fear and hatred of Donald Trump and legitimately, you know, a legitimate critique of, like, of nationalism? I mean, what's your take there?
I think it's like 90% anti-Trump animus. If you're definitely actually trying to assign, like, Trump just makes people angry. So when Trump associates himself with an idea, if you can be uncharitable to that idea, people do it.
Absolutely.
So I think it has to be. I mean, maybe there's 10% a legitimate critique of nationalism, and I'm sure people like Bill Kristol and the Weekly Standard.
Well, what would those critiques be? Like, talk that through. Because, you know, on this podcast, I don't want anybody to ever accuse us of just being, you know, one-sided and just hammering things home. We want to talk about it from both sides. I mean, are there legitimate critiques of a nationalistic perspective?
Well, when the nation takes priority over the individual to an extreme, mm-hmm. right? So anything in extreme.
But that sounds like fascism.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's like, it morphs, right? When you go into the extreme, if you prioritize the nation and the air quotes, the good of the nation, right? Over the individual, and you end up sacrificing the individual rather than lifting up all individuals.
Right. It can also be too much prioritization of national interest and in disregard of the rights and interests of foreign people, right?
Right.
Not citizens. So if, you know, you get to the point where you're purely national interest focused, then maybe you think it's in your national interest to conquer a country and subjugate them.
Right.
Right. Now you can, again, Hazzoni would make the argument that once you start doing that, you're outside of nationalism, as a foreign policy question, because nationalism as a foreign policy theory is one that respects individual nation state sovereignty and thinks that the ideal world is one where you have plenty of individual nation states pursuing their own objectives. But
is the idea sort of that in the same way that a libertarian would expect that individuals would make unique decisions with themselves as the priority, and then when all the unique individuals come together, that their decision-making will optimize outcome for the society at large? Is that sort of the same thinking when it comes to nation states being individual units that are self-preserving, self-motivated, but then also trying to find a way to work sort of together collectively in a global environment?
Yeah, there's a little, I think there's a little bit of that in terms of like, there's a little bit of idealized thinking about what happens when nations are individually pursuing their own interests. Does that necessarily lead to good things, right? Like, that's the sort of, no, actually, the, you know, the world is a state of anarchy. And if you have all these individual nation states that are actually competing for power, then you get, you know, world wars, you get
right. Cause in, on a individual level with humans and inside your markets and your country, you're constrained mm-hmm. by the law.
Right.
You know, nation states aren't necessarily, I mean, sure there's international orders and international trade agreements and, you know, the UN and whatever, but really at the end of the day, like, there's not really international law constraining people from doing things. If they want to just go out there and invade the country next door to them, they're just going to do it. When has that ever been sanctioned? Well, I guess the UN does a little bit of that, but
really the UN's acting basically like as the US's sort of surrogate in that regard. When it's, I mean, the US is maintaining the global world order. And in many ways we are actually a functional empire, even though I'm anti-imperialist in that sense, but we're a functional empire. We guarantee the safety of the world shipping lanes. We have the biggest military in the world, and we are the people who make, you know, essentially operate kind of as a world's policeman, telling people like, don't invade, right? Like, we are the big, you're not going to mess with us. And we, that is against our interests. So don't do it.
Are you familiar with this independent journalist? Is it Caitlin Johnstone?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's been writing a lot lately about how the US military is like the worst thing that ever happened to planet Earth. And that we need to pull back immediately, exclusively with the exclusive goal of just defending our borders. And that's the only thing that the US military should be used for. And I tried to talk to her about it. She's like, well, no one has been trying to invade the United States forever. Why do we need to be force projecting all over the country? And now this is like a woman that gets pretty good traction, right? She's got mm-hmm. thousands and thousands of readers and she's pretty well regarded. And I tried to remind her, by force projection, other people aren't projecting their force, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the absence of an invading army is not it's not a guarantee that there won't be invading armies. It's just a testament to the strength of the military. But B, I brought up this very same question about the shipping lanes. Like, we have other interests, like nations, and this is a really interesting question between nationalism and globalism. Mm-hmm. Nation states defend their interests,
right?
Not just necessarily their borders,
right?
Right, and it's in our interest to have the shipping lanes open all around the world, and it's our interest to have certain things be stable and under our dominion and whatnot. That's not necessarily about empire, and it's not necessarily about globalism, but specifically about our national interests. And to what extent is that conversation being had in this globalist versus nationalist debate?
Well, I think, you know, that almost isn't really, I wouldn't say it necessarily fits on either side of it. It's kind of more it's kind of both libertarianism and left libertarianism, which devolves to this like pacifism, almost isolationism. I don't want to be too unfair to, you know, the Rand Paul types, but like, there is that little strain of that that's just like, we should just not do any of this stuff, period, right? It's wrong. We shouldn't be in any wars, period. We shouldn't have a military overseas, period. They shouldn't be stationed in South Korea, say, right? You know, that's like South Korea, just as a quick side note, is one of those things that I really flipped my mind on. You know, I would think when I was a libertarian, I was like, why do we have 50,000 troops in South Korea? And then once I became a conservative, I was like, because that way North Korea knows that if they drop a bomb on Seoul, that the United States is pot committed, that we are not going anywhere, that we will have lost a huge number of men, and that we will, you know, we will retaliate with overwhelming force.
Right. Pot committed is a term borrowed from poker, which means that you've got enough money in the pot relative to in your stack that you have to keep going in the hand. You have right. no choice, no rational choice, but to move forward.
Right. So that served to deter North Korea from doing anything silly.
Right.
And that is one of our foreign policy interests, right? It's not in the United States' national interest to have a war between North and South Korea. It's just not. We trade with South Korea. We like South Korea. They're a bulwark against potential China, which is the next potential great power threat to the United States. I mean, it's not in our interest to see a war between North and South Korea. So if you are a Caitlin Johnstone type, you might say, well, that's too bad. Like, so what if North Korea and South Korea go to war? And to me, that's like, well, it's clearly not in our national interest to have that happen. But two, it's also kind of appalling to just be indifferent to that outcome from a human perspective, right? Like, and that's what I mean by that's the potential for nationalism to go too far, where you say, I simply do not care about what happens to people in other countries, right? And that can't be right. Because, like, again, if we're talking about concentric circles of care, there still is some amount of care that you, some ethical amount of duty that you owe to people who aren't citizens of your country. And one of them is probably to not be utterly indifferent to whether or not they go to war and die.
Yeah, but there is a line that we have to draw, because obviously we're not trying to get involved in every humanitarian issue around the world. So it's not really the code of ethics that's or duty that's motivating us. It's money, right?
Sure. And I mean, much of that is certainly national interest. But again, it's just a question of, it's a question of prioritization. Like the globalists would say that this kind of prioritization is immoral. Like Emmanuel Macron just said that. He just said it's immoral to prioritize the interests of your own citizens over the citizens of other countries.
So what is his prioritization system then?
It's the one that leads to having a 20% approval rating.
Yeah. Whatever it is, it's not working.
It's not working.
Right. Yeah. So that's the question for me. Is like, if you're gonna replace this system of prioritizing yourself and your community and then your nation first with the interests of people globally, well, now you've got an even bigger pool of competing priorities that you're going to need to start to prioritize. And how the hell, what is the system for prioritizing the demands, needs, crises, whatever, of are we up to 7 billion? I feel like we all just exaggerate the number. It was like 5 billion yesterday, 6 billion today, 7 billion today, whatever. But I mean, it's not growing that fast, is it? But like 7 billion seems to be the accepted number these days, doesn't it? But you know, how do you begin to prioritize that kind of stuff? And by the way, like, whose money are you going to be using to do all that with? Oh, you're going to use my money,
right?
You're gonna use my money in this nation, in this nation state, through our taxes and such, to what, dude, all of a sudden prioritize other people around the world. Now, how much of this is really rhetoric and how much of it is actually real, like on the ground in terms of policy? You know, I think we've made an argument here that things that look globalist could actually be nationalist in terms of really just defending our national interest. It just happens to be that it includes building a global structure to, you know, monitor and control trade, or, you know, building a system of laws and treaties that are going to enable functioning shipping lanes and whatnot. These are the items that people include in the sort of globalist agenda, right? Mm-hmm. These transnational organizations and multi-party agreements and force projection militarily and whatnot. But how much of it is really serving a globalist goal versus serving a nationalistic goal? And I wonder, like, what policy Marcon would implement that would be different, you know, if he had versus Trump, let's say, or just versus the nationalists, let's say. Like, how much of this is just fucking dick waving and saber rattling and whatever than actual real life difference on the ground in terms of policy?
Well, I mean, one example is, I think Obama, though, you remember the web registry institution? Like, we controlled, I don't know exactly what it was.
Oh yeah, ICANN.
ICANN, right. Yeah. We controlled that, right? Yeah. And then we gave it to the UN. Why? I don't know.
Right.
Right. From a nationalist perspective, that doesn't make any sense, right? Our national interest is best served by controlling this thing. Why would we not want to? A globalist perspective would say, well, we don't have the moral right to own it. Like, it belongs to humanity. Hmm. It's like, but no, actually, we do own it, though, and we don't have to give it up. And our national interest is not served by giving up, right? The globalist logic is the only one that could say we have an ethical duty to humanity to give up things to humanity. But it's like, no, our interests come first. We're nationalists, you know? Like, we have an ethical duty to consider people in other countries, and they're not an ethical zero, but their interests do not come before ours.
Choose the option that has the fewest least consequences, right? Yeah. Like, do what reminds me, Jack, of what you used to say: doing what I want while doing the most good.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Make as much money as I can while doing as much good as I can at the same time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, this brings up another conversation that I had. The guy's name is escaping me, but his name's Alex, and he is the head immigration guy at Cato, I think.
Noraste.
Yeah. And to his credit, he's been really cool in terms of engagement on Twitter. I've reached out to him a number of times to have these conversations on immigration. he is a completely wide open, no fences, like no border, no passport control, like just come one, come all.
Literally, immigration control is unconstitutional. Like
and immoral.
Yeah.
That's the argument that he would make, I think.
Right.
And he's been really cool in terms of engaging with me on that. And what I'm struggling with is trying to create like a mental model of the world that where your morality for like your fellow man, like does it extend globally, or does it like, is there an actual end to it? Because sometimes your self-interest, you know, are going to compete with other people's self-interest. And, you know, how do we square like being good people with, you know, the border of your nation being the end of your morality. If that makes, I guess I'm having a little trouble explaining this concept, but you know, if you believe that like the United States is a great economic driver and a way to bring people out of poverty and a place for great opportunity, then I think that there can be a pretty solid argument made that you'd be like, hey, you know, if you want to make your life better, come to the United States, because it will expand human happiness and reduce human suffering. But at the same time, you know, we have to also focus on our own priorities here at home, and to what extent that's going to impact us. So I think that's the trade-off I'm thinking. It's like, I can help these people in this other country by A, giving them money, having them come to the United States, letting them work here, whatnot, but it all comes at a cost, and I'm trying to figure out how to square those costs. And the same sort of moral framework that you apply to your neighbors and to your family and to people living in your community, are we supposed to or expected to apply that same moral framework to people that live outside of our country? And then how do we do that? And if we do that, do we even have a nation? Like what is really dividing us as a nation state versus other people, aside from obviously the Constitution and whatever, living in the United States, but why, like, how does that impact our moral systems?
I mean, what divides us, there's a number of different questions in that comment. What divides us, to start there, is, you know, language, culture, you know, common history, common myths, common understanding, common loyalty to whatever, that, you know, all those things, that we can rightly expect people within the country to be more likely to have that. And that's why, you know, when we go, feel like you're in that different a country when you go to Albuquerque or Seattle. I mean, it's different than DC, but it's still America. Like, same restaurants, same language, same concerns. We're all in the same news. Like,
we're all in the same news.
We're all in the same news cycle. It's not that different. So because we're all in that boat, we have, I think, arch each other more, you know, more care and concern than we do people in other countries that we have potential immigrants.
But is that unique to the United States, those defining characteristics of what makes up your nation state? I think even that perspective is
sure.
American, distinctly American.
Sure. I mean, that perspective is distinctly American, but in that perspective is also then part of what binds us, right?
But if you look up the definition of nationalism, one phrase that comes up is the idea of a national consciousness. So I think that idea that, you know, you go to Albuquerque or Seattle and you know you're in America, right? Because mm-hmm. we all kind of share this unspoken, unconscious feeling together. And you can go to France, you can go to any other country, and there's a similar feeling, right? If you're an outsider, because they all share this one kind of national consciousness.
Yeah, like, you know when you're an expat and you know when you're not an expat, American. Like, that's a really powerful, different feeling when you're in a foreign country. Like, you're just not, you're not part of it.
Right.
And that's not ethnically driven. That's the consciousness.
Right. Yeah. So you don't speak the language. You don't get what their concerns are. You don't.
Right. Because, I mean, even going to like Anglo countries, like as a white American, you go to an Anglo country and you're like, oh yeah, this is not
my place. I am not English.
I am not from here.
Right. Yeah. I am not, you know, I may have, like, you go to my ancestry and my DNA test and you'll end up like, yes, I have a lot of English DNA, but I am not English.
Right.
Right. I'm American.
So our nationalistic consciousness is made up of what, shared experience, culture, values, attitudes,
you know, all the things that make up social dynamics.
Flavors. Yeah. And to what extent are those malleable? And then if you think about that changing, and then yet our like organizational documents are sort of fixed. depending on your perspective, right? I wonder, you know, as things shift and change, and you know, I'm just trying to understand what people's perspective of nationalism is and what the negative critiques are here. And this is sort of one of those roads, I think, is are the American binds of nationalism stronger or weaker than other cases globally that may have different foundations for their binding nature?
Oh, I think we're weaker in terms of the actual things that bind 300 million people together. They're going to be weaker than a place like Poland or Hungary.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Which has a much more dramatic history. It's like Poland, especially, right? Poland, you saw their independence. They had 200,000 people in the streets of Warsaw. This is not a big country. Right. Like there's a very strong nationalistic feeling in Poland.
Well, they have the extra binding component of ethnic homogeneity. Thank you.
Homogeneity.
There we go. Three of us. We finally got
it. I think the U.S. is stronger and weaker. Right. One thing that makes us unique is that we were kind of one of the first countries to decide that we are all going to be bound by principles and philosophy and a document and things like the Enlightenment ideals and not ethnic heritage, right? Because you can say that the United States is a country of immigrants, right? Hmm. I know.
There's a lot in there.
There is a lot in there. So in a way, we were like, we were the first. We pioneers in these Enlightenment ideals. And that's what I was always told growing up.
Right.
Well, what does it mean to be American? It doesn't matter what color you are. It matters that you believe in freedom and democracy and free speech and all these things.
Right. But I think that's like the very defining characteristic of like civic nationalism right there.
Right.
Right. But at the same time, you go to Poland. I've been to Poland and I was in awe of this feeling that they have of their nationalism and how they are so united, and they're united very specifically in like deep cultural heritage history for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, whereas we've only been a nation, you know, for 300 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right? I mean, they've only been a nation in terms
technically,
since World War I. But yeah, I mean, I get your point is well taken, that they've got this very deep, strong feeling. On the other hand, we have 300 million people under the global superpower.
Right.
Right. And, you know, trying to unify 300 million people around around a shared, you know, that level of like, especially something like shared ethnicity. I mean, impossible in the United States.
There's
the United
no way.
States was multi-ethnic from founding, and it's a core part of the history that binds us together is things like the Civil War, mm-hmm. fought to liberate the slaves, World War II, the Civil Rights Act and the mm-hmm. Civil Rights Struggle, right? Like these things are, if history is what unites a people or a big part of it, then you can't create an ethno-state in the United States that would be in any sense American.
Right.
That would connect to any of that type of American nationalism, unless you skipped 300 years of history.
Right. Started like yesterday, basically.
Went back to like pre-founding.
Right. So this is getting me to the point that I was trying, you know, want to lead us to, which is we lack the sort of ethnic, racial unification. And the American consciousness and our founding documents, but this consciousness that you spoke of is what really defines what it means to be an American. So to what extent does that consciousness require handling? To what extent does that consciousness require some level of care and application and intentionality and proactive engagement with it? How do we foster it? Can we guide it certain places? Has that happened in history? Is that problematic? Is it something that we just leave to evolve on its own? Or is it something that we need to be cognizant of and conscious of and something that we need to really put our hands on to sort of control, because it is ethereal and it could go away.
Right.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel it going away, right?
I think it's something that's been fostered in the past. I mean, you look at pictures and images and traditions, and you missed school to go to parades, right? To celebrate your country. You said the Pledge of Allegiance every single day in school.
Man, you remember that?
Holy cow. You were told that America was the best country and we're so lucky to be here. And now if you were to tell your child that, or a teacher in a public school were to say that America is the best country and we should all be so grateful to be here, I mean, they would lose their job.
Yeah.
That would be blasphemous. You know?
So what kind of handling do you have to put on something like this, Will?
I mean, I think you have to do significant effective propaganda work on behalf of American nationalism. Because if you don't, it's not like an ethnic nationalism that just, it's just sort of entrenched in the place, right? Like if you're in an ethnically homogenous place, you know, the extent to which you all feel bound or unified together is probably a lot more robust than if it's, you know, you are members of different cultural tribes, but unified by this civic commitment.
So would you say that the binds are weaker?
Mm-hmm. I'd say that the binds are weaker binding Americans together than binding Poles together, for instance. I think it's just hard not to look at Poland and think the opposite. That said, Poland is at a disadvantage because it can only be Poles, right? Mm-hmm. Like they can't just form a, you know, they're trying to make a European superstate to compete on a great power level with the United States and with China and with Russia. They can't, doesn't work. You know, like they're desperately trying and it doesn't work because they don't have the same national history or national identity. And as a result, they are limited to having strong nationalisms within very small geographic places. Whereas because our nationalism is inherently more flexible, it's inherently more tolerant, we can integrate a lot more people easily. And it also means we have an advantage when it comes to integrating new talent, right? Like say we want access to the best entrepreneurs in the world, the best technologists in the world. Well, English is the lingua franca. America has a history of accepting immigrants and making it easy for immigrants to become American when they get here. So there's real power and there's a big national interest in making American nationalism accessible. Hmm. That said, it's not just you snap your fingers, you become an American. I mean, if somebody comes here as a Wahhabi, a committed Wahhabi believer in Wahhabi Islam, in what sense are they meaningfully becoming American by moving here if their fundamental ideology conflicts with everything, anything that would be a unifying American ideal?
Yeah.
And
is that not a fatal flaw of an open system that it can and will attract and permit those in its midst that are
actively working against it?
Yeah, or fatally oriented?
I think it's a flaw. I just don't necessarily think it's fatal, right? It's the downside of being tolerant is that sometimes you tolerate things you shouldn't.
Right.
And, I mean, on net, we're better off in a world where we have a lot of tolerance and occasionally tolerate too much, I think. Like, you know, and as a result, you know, I'm pro-immigration restriction, but also pro-immigration. Like, but I think it's really, really important to American national interests to continue to bring in talented, top-level people, regardless of, you know, creed. And
I remember I got in trouble for writing something about we need to give like thoughtful control, immigration control, but then we need to embark on like a 20-year propaganda program of like America together, or we are America, or America first or something. And someone, when I got during my like doxing and this time when the media was paying attention to like old words that I had written, people dug that up and said that was like, this guy's he's like a straight up fascist. Like, like saying I was a fascist because I thought that the government should work to build an American consciousness, was deemed fascism. Now I can see if your goal is to build this American consciousness into, you know, one that supports the state at all costs and then, you know, exports hate and violence and starts invading other countries and whatnot. But to say that any effort towards building a national identity is a fascist tendency, I think is really going to limit us. And it seems to me that one of our political parties today is anti-American consciousness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Hillary Clinton's campaign, in the way that she adopted, and I'm bringing in another subject real quick here, but the way she adopted the language of intersectionality and radical feminism, and all these concepts that are anathema to Western civilization and the primacy of the individual, I don't know why she wanted to become president. Like, why would you want to become president of the United States, the leader of Western civilization, when your faction, members of your coalition, members of your faction, members of the party are actually anti-Western civilization and anti-America? I don't get that. Do you understand that?
Well, I mean, for Hillary Clinton, it's just power, right? Yeah. Right? Like, if you're trying to understand Hillary Clinton's motivations,
right?
That's pretty simple.
Yeah, she wants power.
I was giving her a little bit more credit than she deserved there.
The general problem of I think the left not having a unifying ideology for the country. I mean, other than sort of unifying against white people, in my judgment, like I don't, you know,
white men,
right? Like the. I call the Democratic Party institutionally bigoted now, because I don't want to use institutionally racist, because the debate about whether or not they're racist just seems, I want to avoid it.
Right, because they stole the word racism away from being actually prejudiced and acting on those prejudices, and now they've incorporated you have to have the sense of power.
Right, exactly. So I sidestepped that debate, because they haven't redefined bigotry yet, and they certainly are bigoted. Right?
Certainly are bigoted. And not only the Democratic Party, but then the institutions which support the Democratic Party, things that we call the blue church, right? The mm-hmm. entertainment, media, commercial marketing complex, to where there are open bigots on the editorial board at the New York Times that mm-hmm. in all seriousness have said blanket statements about trying to induce crime and terror basically against white men in particular. And the open institutional bigotry, as you described it, I mean, mm-hmm. it's like not even hidden anymore. It's not right. obscured.
Oh, it's celebrated.
It's right. It's celebrated. It's a way to gain yeah. status amongst mm-hmm. Amongst their peers. So, you know, people have asked me in like AMAs and questions like, "Do you think there's going to be a civil war?" And you know, we're clearly in a cold civil war already, right? And like, I'm a casualty. You know, Red Hen is a casualty by virtue of living with me. My children are casualties by virtue of being in my household because of mm-hmm. the way that things went down. But is there going to be a hot civil war? I don't know. But this idea that there's enemies in our midst, I mean, mm-hmm. open bigotry, institutionalized bigotry, and open criticism of the concept of what it means to be an American or America or the American experiment or the American consciousness, that's already here. And it's already sort of tearing us apart.
Yeah. I mean, and to me, that's sort of like, what is the big ideological project for the right? It's to defeat that, right? It's to say that doesn't get to win. We, you know, institutional bigotry against a major portion of our population isn't okay, right? We don't think racism's okay. Well, this isn't okay either.
Right.
I mean, yes, racism was a more profound evil, especially at the time it was, right? But that doesn't mean you suddenly, that open institutional bigotry against white people is okay. It's not.
Right.
And it's disunifying, one, right? It's pitting citizens against other citizens, not okay. And it's just something that just doesn't sit right with me personally, right? It's not okay. And so that's like the ideological project of the right is what winning this cold civil war looks like, is defeating the left electorally enough to the point that they're like, hey, you know, this intersectionality stuff, that was dumb. We're going to go back to Bill Clinton and like
yeah.
being a moderate, being, even almost a conservative.
Yeah.
Right. And then back to like, hey, maybe we should unify as a country together around American ideals. It's like, once you have that, then like debates about healthcare and all the other stuff, that's all just technocracy. That's fine. You know, however that comes down, America is still going to be America at the end of the day. But if we lose the debate about like this major cultural ideological issue, you know, big trouble.
Well, I think that the midterm results showed that that divide is becoming even more profound. You know, I think I saw the voting breakdowns from some exit polls that showed, you know, something like 98% of black women voted Democrat and, you know, 70-some% of white women. I may have these numbers wrong, but it's pretty clear that the way the voting is breaking down across racial and gender divides. How do we stop that from happening? Or what kind of conversation do we have with people in order to, you know, look, I think polarization inevitably is bad for us, mm-hmm. right? We don't want one party to be the party of like minorities and what do you say, people of color, mm-hmm. and one party to be the party of white people.
Yeah, that's not good.
That's not good. But that, in a way, I mean, I think the numbers are showing that that's the case, right?
Right. And I think part of it is, you know, the Republican Party doesn't have a history of being particularly woke on racial issues and in ways that have given it a lack of credibility about talking about things like, you know, like criminal justice reform, even issues when Republicans talk about them, like Democrats rightly don't feel like Republicans are meaningfully committed to those issues, right? That they've got any skin in the game on those issues. They'll talk a good game, but their home.
Well, they got skin in the game. They got the, you know, their private prisons that they run.
That's it.
Yeah. So on this same tip, I have long advocated for the decriminalization of cannabis and marijuana on a federal level. Mm-hmm. And I feel like right now, man, the Republicans should be really seizing upon that one. It fits in the libertarian perspective of low government. It fits in a federalist perspective that they're going to argue when they try to challenge Roe v. Wade, right? And it's a legitimate civil liberties issue in that the African-American community gets incarcerated at a far greater rate for the same offenses and endures longer prison sentences for the same offenses than for white people when it comes to pot usage and pot distribution. So you're absolutely right that the Republican Party doesn't have a great history here. And I think this is a question that I get on the college tour. Kids are like, how do you know, in the Q&A afterwards, like 19-year-old kid is like, how do we convince people that we're not racist?
I mean,
that's a tough one, right?
It's action, not words.
Right. Which is what I told them.
And, you know, like that's, people aren't going to be convinced by words that you're not racist. They have to like see you in action and like realize that you actually have everybody's best interests at heart or as much as possible. And to some extent, you know, I mean, you can't perfectly empathize with anybody. You're ultimately constrained by your own experiences, right? Like to the extent there's a critique of kind of like this sort of white wokeness, if you will, it's that like, no, you haven't walked a mile in my shoes. You can't walk a mile in my shoes when you purport to understand my experience. You're full of it. You don't. Right. But that doesn't mean the counter to that is, but yeah, I should try though, right? I should try to empathize. I should try to like put myself in your shoes. I should try to fully understand what's going on.
Well, what I tried to tell them was like, look, this isn't your grandfather's Republican Party, right? Like we saw the rainbow flag up on stage, you know, I think at the Republican convention. I've been saying that a lot. I need to double check that. I think that's true. You got Donald Trump saying that the gay marriage is settled law. And I think that there's a lot of social issues that have sort of fallen to the side now because they become settled, like gay marriage has been settled. And that was one thing, gay marriage and pot and like the drug war were like two issues that really kept me solidly on the left for a long time.
Yeah.
And once those have been, you know, the gay marriage is resolved and pot decriminalization seems imminent, right? Mm-hmm. It could be now, it could be in 5 years, but the trends seem to be solidly in place. That to me opened up the ability for me to make a transition. And of course you couple it with like the craziness coming out of the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats themselves are making it impossible for a white masculine male to remain a part of their coalition. There's like absolutely no self-respecting man, white man, can be a Democrat today because the Democrat Party not only tolerates but supports and spreads a message of hate and anti-masculinity and anti-white guy.
Like, right, I agree.
Yeah, and it sounds crazy to say that, but have there been recent events or have you always sort of felt like that or what's driven you to come to that conclusion? Because I know what it's been for me. I mean, it's just sort of like my lived experience.
No, I mean, I had that lived experience in college debate where like I was a lone kind of libertarian, moderate conservative around nothing but hyper-liberals. And, you know, there was a time where it was fine. It was really policy-centric debate, and we were having disagreements about healthcare and gun reform. And so whatever, you know, those are just technocratic issues. But at a certain point, things changed, and they got to a point where I was routinely being called racist in debates without justification.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Like in college debate tour.
Yeah, and these are like, you know, people who knew better too. Like, I knew what I was saying and I was being very careful with it. Like if you called those things racist, you were just wrong.
Right.
You know, saying things about evolutionary psychology is not racist, right? It's just,
oof,
you know,
that's a can of worms.
Yeah. Like that's one example. And, also just sort of a move in debate towards this, just kind of lionization of victimhood and arguments that were unbeatable because they were so woke, right? Like the idea, you know, topic might be a policy debate about prosecutorial authority. The affirmative get up and say debate is racist. It is anti-black. Here, you know, we are standing up against debate and being anti-black is bad. And the negative couldn't get up and say, like, you shouldn't say that. Obviously everybody agrees, right? that like racism is bad. That shouldn't be your affirmative thesis that you get to defend in this debate.
That's and gonna, I'm on that's team racism good.
Right. Yeah.
Like, that's dumb.
Long debate there. Well, is racism bad?
Go. Yeah.
I think that's one thing these college kids are really feeling, because everything is so extreme on a college campus. Mm-hmm. It's the most extreme, and it's also so condensed, right? It's their little tiny community, and that's what you live in for 4 years. And just by being white, they're automatically racist. Mm. So it doesn't, I think a lot of them feel like it doesn't matter what they do, doesn't matter what they say, because unless they can somehow change the color of their skin, they're always going to be considered racist.
Yeah. And Red Hen has seen all this firsthand with me, because she not only supports me at home, but supports me on the road too. And so she's come to each of these events, and she watches and hears the questions and sees the sincerity of these kids, you know. It's just like a 19-year-old boy.
I mean, they seem genuinely scared.
Yeah.
And overwhelmed. I think this huge feeling of being overwhelmed by the lack of options and opportunities. And
so, care.
Yes.
And care.
They feel like no one cares about them, because when you can't even have a discussion, right? They, at each event, we've had at least two questions saying, how do I talk to someone on the left?
Right.
How do I just have a conversation with someone who doesn't agree with me? Mm-hmm. And it is mind-blowing that that is a question that people need help with, right? Well, the fact that you just can't even, you can't agree to disagree, because if you disagree with me, says someone on the left, then you are a racist, you are a bigot, you are sexist, you're a terrible human being.
Right. The left has effectively shut down debate by saying, you know, if you just disagree with us, you're a morally deficient embodiment.
Words.
No words. Bad words. Embodiment. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Of evil. And one of the things I've seen in kids' faces as I give my talk to them, where I talk about in my book Democrat to Deplorable, I talk about the college section, where I broke down the orientation program at American University, and I showed how the materials and the concepts that they present say, A, you're a racist, B, you are, we don't care about science, C, did I go 1, 2, C? ABC. C, that language is, you can manipulate language and control reality that way through, you know, the pronouns and other things. And D, that the words that you say, they're judged by the way people feel about what you've said rather than the merit of your statement. And I break that all down, and I explain it in the book, and I explain it in my talks, and I see the lights in the eyes of the college kids. They're just like, somebody finally put it all together for them and has like helped coalesce this negative energy that they're feeling. Mm-hmm. and put it into an organized sort of package, so that it all of a sudden they seem to stop feeling crazy and start to feel like, oh yeah, no wonder I'm feeling like that, because this is insane. And now somebody else has told me that it's insane, and it's really helped me see that it is. And now I don't feel like a terrible person anymore.
Right.
Which is all part of the plan, right? To make you feel like a terrible person.
Right. It's, I mean, yeah, it's to push you in a place where you bend to the will of this ideology.
Yeah, it's classic manipulation. I mean, it's nothing but essentially, no, I don't want to say brainwashing, but...
No, it's 100% brainwashing. Yeah. It's 100% brain mind control. And when people say that they're indoctrination camps, colleges these days, they're absolutely right.
Oh, yeah.
In my research, something like 92% of people that went Democrat to Deplorable said that the state of affairs on college campuses is very alarming to them and motivated them to vote, because they had some idea that Donald Trump was going to be able to make influence on the state of affairs on college campuses. Now, I think that that's actually happening. Mm-hmm. It's a slow moving ship. He's working on Title IX reforms through the Department of Education, which is a huge thing we can talk about later. But those kind of things are going to take extended period of time to shift institutions. I mean, if it's even possible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm bearish on the possibility of real meaningful change in the universities. I think they've been totally co-opted by the most radical faction of the left. And, you know, I would just defund them, just aggressively defund them. Like, I don't understand why the federal government needs to continue to fund these places. Right. Or rather, at least the departments that aren't hard sciences.
Right.
Like, and maybe history and a few other disciplines that are like not hard science, but you know, have sufficient rigor. But like anything that ends in studies can just go away, can just be defunded. Y'all can fund it with your own donations.
So you know, somebody who is not necessarily familiar with you or me, Will, and like the writing and speaking that we've been doing over the last few years, somebody could dip their toe into this conversation and maybe perceive some of the things we've talked about as being radical, mm-hmm. and could be all thrown into that basket of deplorables.
Here we go.
On the right. And you know, people will say that just having a conversation around nationalism, people will say having a conversation that involves evolutionary psychology, biology, people will say that having a conversation about race, mm-hmm. man, we must be a bunch of alt-righters up here.
Yeah, funny story about that.
The answer is no, everybody.
The answer is no. The answer is like, both of us have actually, like, I think aggressively fought the alt-right in our own ways. And, you know, we can talk about, like, we've succeeded. I mean, mostly I think it's they've just committed seppuku. They've made such terrible own errors.
No, but that would be honorable.
Yeah, right, true. Right, true. That's just
giving them a little too much credit.
Right. So no, they fell down and impaled themselves.
Yeah, basically. Right. They just fell down. They were not looking and they fell into a bed of spikes.
They fell down and they could not get up.
Right. And there would be nobody there standing with the sword to like chop their head off and spare them the dishonor of screaming and agonizing. No, we actually want to point and laugh hysterically. No,
while they get dragged through discovery and civil litigation in Charlottesville.
Just to be clear, we are talking about the alt-right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Not Democrats?
Yeah, there we go.
We're talking about the alt-right now.
We're being very specific.
Democrats have not committed suicide. That's very different, right? Democrats are...
honorable suicide, definitely not. Now, one of the topics that we had down here on our list of things to talk about was the death of the alt-right. And, you know, I was just thinking, because like I said, I want this podcast to be, you know, self-critical and open-minded and taking different perspectives. So I was listening to things that we were saying. Mm-hmm. And to somebody who is not tuned into the definitions that we're using and is not tuned into sort of our ongoing discussion and conversation. So basically somebody who's mildly ignorant, and I'll use mm-hmm. that in a technical way.
Right.
Could, you know, swoop in, hear this conversation, be like, oh my God, they're talking about nationalism. They're talking about propaganda campaigns to make us all believe we're Americans. It sounds like ethnic erasure and racism and all this horrible stuff. But, you know, talk a little bit about our experiences with the alt-right. What happened to the alt-right? Where are they? And
should we define them?
I mean, to me, like, the alt-right is an umbrella group. I think almost nobody identifies with the name anymore. Even the white nationalists are like, ew, alt-right, the branding is so bad, right?
Which is a bummer, because the term alt-right in a vacuum,
yeah,
is a cool name.
Right. It's too bad that they, you know, Richard Spencer decided, no, I own this cool name, and here, let me get Nazi goop all over it. Right. Like, understanding the phenomena of Nazi goop is actually quite useful, right? Like, these people get Nazi goop over things.
It's pretty bad when even the white nationalists won't hang out with you.
You mean the alt-right, not
yeah.
us. Yes. Won't hang out with the name.
Let's just, yeah, you we'll know, take that name.
It's just such a fine line to walk. So, yeah. So, I mean, basically, I think the alt-right has come to mean people that are very specifically oriented around some sort of ethno-state, or wishing, and this is tying back our original conversation here, is wishing that the binds that held their nation together were of ethnic origin rather than of cultural consciousness. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually the most charitable way anybody has ever defined
right.
that, right?
They think, I mean, they believe that, must that make race me a racist. Is real and central, and that essential to national identity. Like they reject the distinction, I think, between the nation and the race that makes up the nation. Whereas right. I think that distinction is exceedingly important. And I don't think, also I reject the premise inherent in that, which is the idea that a nation can't be multi-ethnic.
Right.
Right. Like, I think America is very clearly a multi-ethnic nation and a multi-ethnic country, and that an ethnic nationalism is un-American. Right. It doesn't fit into our history and into our understanding of ourselves.
Well, right. And then if you're just going to like judge the performance of this American consciousness on the global scale, I mean, how else would you do it besides like GDP and military power? So like whatever we have living here in America, whomever's been here for the last however many 200 plus years, it's obviously working. Mm-hmm. Right. So to say that it's impractical or non-functional or suboptimal, either on a political scale, on an economic scale, or even on a evolutionary scale, mm-hmm. Would be completely false, right? So right. So when people are talking about ethnostates, they're really talking about suboptimal outcomes, right?
Oh, I mean, it would be disastrous. We're not even talking suboptimal. I mean, the breakup of the United States into distinct ethnic nations would lead to both internal war and also a collapse of the world order. I mean, you know, the entire world order is rooted around the United States as the dominant superpower.
Right. So this notion is fucking absurd, is what it is. Yeah, right?
It is. And it was from the get-go. Now they're kind of modifying it. Their argument is more, well, we need to maintain a white supermajority in the United States. And for me, it's like, that's not actually a relevant metric in my judgment at all. Right. Like, to me, it's like, you know, America doesn't stay America. It's going to depend on the ideology, right? It's going to depend on the dominance of particular political factions. It's not going to depend on whether or not you're counting members of a particular race and seeing that they add up to the right number. Especially because, like, just, you know, like, white people aren't unified at all. Right. Like, at all. They're completely different tribes.
Right. But I think what we've seen, though, in the voting is that by and large, the minority groups are unified in their voting. Yeah. And one of the characteristics that unifies them, at least some of their woke, air quotes again, that's really effective on a podcast, mm-hmm. using air quotes or facial expressions or eye rolls, especially.
I will get better at the eye rolls, sir.
Is that sort of an opposition to white power, white hegemony, right. hegemony,
and that's bad for the project of American nationalism, right? It descends into competing ethnic nationalisms, which is almost what that reflects, a kind of descent into competing ethnic nationalism.
Correct, right? So, my point in even bringing this up is that the Democratic Party has in its coalition people who are ethnically oriented in their approach to politics.
Right.
And so one of the questions I asked in my book, and I think this might be one of the more, quote, dangerous things that I did bring up, is that if people in the minority parties are gleefully anticipating the moment at which they become a majority voting bloc, what is driving that glee? And, you know, what does that mean? So, like, you've said, and I've said, and have thought as well too, that, like, maintaining an alt-right position, which is not our position, of maintaining a white supermajority or majority voting power in the United States is important. Mm-hmm. And we're saying, no, that's not important. It's ideas and ideology, right? Because white people aren't unified. But on the other side, there's minority groups that are like, can't wait till we have voting power. Mm-hmm. Now, is that something to, you know, when is that going to happen? Is there a negative effect to that? That's elevating ethnic division to a national level and a policymaking level.
Right. And so the way I frame it again in terms of ideology, if your ideology is one of ethnic solidarity and waiting to triumph over white people, then your ideology needs to be marginalized, you know, and moreover, like, if your political strategy is to change immigration patterns to increase change the demographic situation so that you're going to win this ethnic battle. It's like, no, that's not okay.
Right. And that's not, you know, we want to prevent anything like that from happening, right. Of course, right. which is why I think we both were talking earlier and something we've considered quite a bit, which is how do we strengthen and fortify the American consciousness in a unified manner? Mm-hmm. And what does that look, you know, these are just rhetorical questions, but like, what does that look like? How are we going to do that moving forward? Is it something that's coordinated on the federal level? Is it something that people do philanthropically? You know, do you do it on Twitter?
I mean, there's just a ton of like cultural work to be done about changing the attitudes of this country and basically making everybody American, right? Like, and really putting these sort of quasi ethnic nationalist splinter groups, making them marginal, right? Making them toxic, making it's like, no, that's, yes, I realize like that's a powerful driver, is like, we as a voting bloc will have power, but that's just not an American way of thinking. No. Like, it's just not. And it doesn't sit with our values.
No. I find it ironic that the very same people that would criticize others for having an ethnic perspective are also then going to bring sort of ethnicity to their forefront of their conversation as well too. But
yeah,
that's another conversation for another day. So I think this is a good place to begin to wrap up, because if anything comes out of this conversation, what I want people to take away from is that it's important for us to foster the American consciousness, that it's important for us to have like a unified idea of who we are and where we're going and what we're doing, whether it's, you know, language, culture, customs, attitudes, expectations, norms, etc. And of course, along the way, we're going to have vigorous and healthy debate. So when we don't have the vigorous and healthy debate, when somebody like me gets deplatformed and banned from just having a regular conversation at a federally funded university,
you know, with law students.
With law students.
That's right. What's particularly upsetting is that it's not just some college, you know, undergrads.
Right. And I was looking forward to talking to the law students too, because I wanted to get deeper into some federal policy and how it changes human behavior, like the way Title IX stretches all the way into college relationships and mating and dating patterns and whatnot, because I think that's a fascinating conversation. Something I actually talked a lot about with Jeffrey Miller on episode number one. So check that out. But, you know, the walk away from this, the takeaway is that, you know, American nationalism is a good thing. To say that it is inherently evil or Hitler-esque, like those young bunnies on CNN, 26 years old, doesn't know anything about anything, but knows, you know, thinks she knows enough to say that being a nationalist is being a Nazi. You know, we want to move away from that type of rhetoric, and I think that we've had a good talk here to really talk. To dig into what nationalism means, what the American consciousness is, and the importance of it, and the sort of unifying evolutionary perspective of like taking care of yourself first, so that you can then also take care of people outside of your circles. And you know, I know for me personally, and for you, Will, that you know, a strong America can benefit the world through its strengths, and I think that's. You know, that's all of a sudden sounds super conservative, old school, right? Like a strong father, strong family, strong neighborhood, strong community, then we can help everybody else. And we lead through strength, and we lead through conviction, and we lead through having a hearty constitution. And, you know, that notion is under attack from all aspects. So there's no surprise to me or to you that the Marxist globalists union that's out there, that they would all be on one side and on folks on the other side advocating a positive masculinity, advocating for a strong family units, advocating for strong communities, for taking care of yourself first, so that then in turn you can worry about everybody else. You know, those dividing lines are pretty clear. And when you lay it out like that, you know, it's really obvious the divisions. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And how they seem to be very, very entrenched. And so that's why communication is good. And that's why getting out there and talking to people is good. But that's going to be it for this one. That's about 90 minutes. You guys have been awesome. Thank you so much, Red Hen. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Next time when we're going to have do an episode, me and Red Hen, we're going to do an episode about relationships. So yes. That's going to be fun, dating and relationships. And Will, thank you very much for coming over and bringing your expertise. We didn't even get to all the items on the list. But I'm pretty sure
you two could sit here for hours and hours.
I think so. And it's going to be great having you on regularly to talk about current events. You know, you've got your debate history, so that makes you a good talker. And, a little bit. And you know, Will, where can people find you online, and how should they reach out to you?
So I am Will Chamberlain on Twitter and Periscope. You can, that's basically the two places you can find me right now, at Will Chamberlain, spelled CHAMBERLAIN.
Perfect, perfect. And Red Hen, what about you?
You can go to Jack Murphy Live's profile and find out all you need to know. No, I am the_red_hen on Twitter.
And not that awful restaurant that kicked
the
press secretary out of from eating there, right?
Some people were very confused.
They were. You got a lot of nasty messages.
I got a lot of hate mail.
Yeah, and I am Jack Murphy, and this is the Jack Murphy Live podcast. You can find me at jackmurphylive.com. There's like 80-some essays on there, lots of podcasts and videos. Go there, check it out. While you're there, sign up for my email list. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit subscribe so that you get the notification of the new releases coming out. If you're listening to this on iTunes, hit subscribe.
What should they hit?
Hit subscribe, everybody. hit subscribe and follow me on Twitter at Jack Murphy Live. That's sort of my home base, and that's the best way to get in touch with me. My DMs are always open, so reach out.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, that's what she said. All right, guys, thank you very much, and we will be back at you pretty soon. Upcoming on the podcast is Dr. David Lay, a clinical psychologist and a sex expert. We're going to talk about pornography and is it terrible or what? So stay tuned for that. And again, thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. See you soon.